Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. So in the past couple of months, I've lost two family members. Most recently, my cousin, my first cousin, Claire, passed away at the age of 92. And about a month or so before her, my Aunt Pearl passed away. If you're a regular listener, you may remember that just a few weeks ago, we had a conversation with my cousin Tom, and we certainly talked about that, the loss of her mother, his mother, my Aunt Pearl, and she was 98. And when I go onto Facebook and I look at the various family members and friends posting things about the passing of these two women, I see things such as, "I'm so sorry for your terrible loss. I'm immensely sad for you," etc., etc. And honestly, I'm certainly not trying to tell anybody how to express their condolences. I can't get myself to do quite that. I can't quite tell someone who's lost a 90-plus-year-old family member to natural causes that I'm extremely sorry for their loss. Quite frankly, if I didn't have any filters, I would probably say, you're free, thank God you're free, especially when this loss is preceded by an extremely lengthy lingering. If we're talking about the passing of a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old, certainly I can see something like that. I'm deeply sorry for your loss, because at that point it really is a loss. And also the term deeply saddened. Billy Graham passed away not too long ago, and I remember reading the statement from Jimmy and Rosalind Carter saying, "We are deeply saddened by the loss of 99-year-old Billy Graham." I'm just wondering, is there any other way to express ourselves to acknowledge those lives? Actually, that's what I did when I went on the family Facebook page and posted about my cousin Claire and my Aunt Pearl. I simply talked about how much they meant to me growing up. I didn't say deeply saddened. I didn't say so sorry for this painful loss, when I know that the immediate family of these people were not going through painful loss. Certainly there is a bit of detachment that has to go on. I'm not saying that it was they were completely stoic in all of this. But nonetheless, it's just a whole different animal when we're talking about people who have a good death, a natural death, and one that is especially fruitful, if I may, one that takes place at home, surrounded by loved ones. Now, today we're going to veer a little bit off of our usual trajectory. Much of the time, as you know, we deal with matters of religion and spirituality. And this is kind of sort of in that area, because we're talking about a book by Dr. Samuel Harrington called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. We're not going to get into theology, we're not going to get into afterlife or anything like that. We're simply talking about the very human experience of transitioning out of the mortal coil. So many times, of course, we speak to people who have lost a loved one under these circumstances, where they're in a bed, they're surrounded by their immediate family, and these people are able to actually witness the parting of that family member, the removal of the soul, if you will. They always refer to it. Anyone I've ever spoken to has said it is a very powerfully spiritual experience. It goes beyond dogma, creed, belief, sectarianism, any of that. It's just something that touches something very deep inside of us. So I would like to tell you a little bit about Dr. Harrington. He's an honors graduate of Harvard, also a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. He concentrated his clinical practice at Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C., There he served as a medical staff leader, a trustee, and Sibley's representative to the Johns Hopkins Quality and Safety Board Committee. This work and his service on the Board of Trustees of a nonprofit hospice brought Dr. Harrington into discussion of end-of-life medical care. So we welcome to Common Threads Dr. Samuel Harrington. Sam, hello.
Fred, thank you for that introduction, and I appreciate your discussion of dying at an advanced age, because although there is a loss quality to it, it's not a tragedy, and if it's natural, that's the best we can hope for, in my opinion.
Indeed, that's of course, and certainly you mention your father. You write a significant amount about the loss of your father, his process of dying, and you say that one of the things he often said was, "I'd just as soon one day wake up dead." And I think most of us would probably opt for that. But you say that the chances of doing that are pretty slim. What are the statistics on that?
Well, I think that if we are lucky enough to live to an old age, and I will arbitrarily say 85 to 90, then 80% of us will dwindle and die and be disabled for at least the last year of our life. And that leaves about 20% who get lucky enough, as you point out with my father's phrase, lucky enough to wake up dead. Of course, we all die of something acute superimposed on something chronic, but most of us will have a chronic illness if we're lucky enough to live to a ripe old age.
And you say how many years after 65 are most people mobile and really functioning?
That I can't be terribly specific on. If we get to 65 and are if we get to 65 in good health, we are likely to live 19 to 20 more years, of which 11 tend to be very good years, and then 8 or 9 tend to be years complicated by progressive illness and disability. And when I say disability, I mean the inability for us to take care of ourselves, what doctors, medical people call the activities of daily living. We lose the ability to dress ourselves or bathe ourselves or feed ourselves, etc. So if we're lucky enough to get to 65, we've got 10 or 11 good years, but then we have, and obviously a disability does not define a bad year, it just means that we will start dwindling at that point.
And how about lifestyle choices? I realize that genes have a tremendous amount to do with both the number of years that you survive and the quality of those years that you survive. Is that not true that, well, yes, both genes do that, but how about prior lifestyle? Let's say you've got two 40-year-olds and they both make it to 65, but when they're 40, one guy is out there on the basketball court or pumping iron or you know, having a very fulfilled life in many ways, and the other guy is just kind of cruising along. Let's say that genetically, they pretty much are in the same ballpark. Can we say scientifically that the guy who exercises at 40, the guy who has an engaged life at 40, might eke out more of a functioning life up until passing at a greater age?
Well, the answer to that is probably, as long as the person doesn't over-exercise and harm themselves by accelerating the degenerative arthritis process most of us undergo. So if they run too much and wear out their knees or their back, they will be limited later on. But I think that, let's say the average, under optimal circumstances, the average life expectancy is roughly 85, and people who live into their 90s or over 100, that's pretty well genetically determined, and people who live less, a shorter lifespan than 85, either brought something on themselves by smoking or drinking too much or not exercising at all or eating a poor diet, indeed also have bad genetic luck in the sense that they have a genetic tendency to a disease. But taking care of ourselves, I mean, I certainly promote a healthy lifestyle, which is largely the result of avoiding too many calories and avoiding tobacco products. And so I promote a healthy lifestyle, but it's not a guarantee that we'll get to a ripe old age.
Oh, certainly, certainly. And yes, I also know people who have just destroyed themselves pretty much in the name of physical fitness. I know someone who, oh my gosh, he's got torn rotator cuffs. He wears braces with his shoes. And he's still he's in his late 60s and he still goes to the gym and just pounds that weight.
There's a character in my book created by another physician that he a caricature also that he describes as the American immortal. The idea that if we lead extremely healthy lifestyles, exercise constantly, meditate regularly, take every vitamin supplement excessively, we'll live forever. And it really sort of blinds us to the facts that, again, we will all, if we're lucky enough to get old, we will dwindle and we will suffer some of the decay that happens with old age. But the American immortal is an interesting character, and I had a couple in my practice like that and who exercised regularly and felt that they could treat everything with diet rather than sort of standard medical practice.
I can't find this in the book right now, but you mentioned something about, please correct me if I'm wrong, something about every generation thinking that they're going to live longer. Do I have that right? Or this generation thinking they're going to live longer?
Yes, you have that right. I think that the baby boomer generation, let me start over, the sort of the greatest generation are currently dying in their 90s at the rate of about 1,000 a day. And they are being followed by the baby boomer generation, of which I am one. The leading edge of the baby boomers are 75, and the trailing edge is in the maybe 55. And that generation has been inundated with lots of media representations of healthcare that's overblown, that in the sense that we see CPR on television is always successful, when in reality it's rarely successful. We see young actors playing aging patients receiving chemotherapy and happily driving off into the sunset, when in fact people who receive chemotherapy may actually be aging and suffering. And we see, we're obsessed with youth and with vitamin supplement business, which is a $27 billion business. So we all think of ourselves as sort of living forever and don't prepare ourselves for the reality of that the end will eventually come.
But you say that this generation thinks they're going to live longer, but isn't that true? Isn't it true that as we progress as a civilization, lifespans are getting longer?
Well, you are correct, although we are sort of topping out in that area. The first part of the book, I discuss a concept called the compression of morbidity, which is a theory that we are living longer and better, and which is a fact that if you compare survival curves from 150 years ago to today, we are living longer in terms of not dying of acute illnesses. I compare the curves and point out that 70 is the new 50, but 86 is the new 85, meaning that 150 years ago, people were dying at age 50 of tuberculosis or certain other infections that we've largely conquered, or appendicitis or heart attacks, and more people are surviving heart attacks now. But if 150 years ago a person was lucky enough to get to be 85, the chronic illnesses that afflict the elderly, such as congestive heart failure, cancer, dementia, we're not doing so well curing those, so that 85-year-old 150 years ago probably just lives to be 86 or 87 currently. And there's an old medical aphorism that it is a doctor's responsibility to help patients die young, as late in life as possible. And that resonates with us in that we all want to live long, vigorous lives and be vigorous right up to the end, but that, again, belies the point I made earlier that if we're lucky enough to live to be 85 or 90, then most of us will be disabled by one of these chronic illnesses.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Samuel Harrington. He is the author of At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Now, doesn't the current state of the medical industry belie the aphorism that you just quoted about helping us all live, helping us die young?
It's a tongue-in-cheek point that, of course, we all want to live long, vigorous lives and be vigorous right up to the end, but we don't. And largely, medical science has advanced to the point where we do that, but it hasn't cured the chronic illnesses that afflict the elderly.
Right. I was thinking of the situations where someone, the medical industry just keeps people hanging on and on and on longer than they should. So they're no longer vigorous, but they're still alive.
Well, there is that. Yes, I take your point. We do, as people age, there is an emphasis on curing the acute illnesses that come to them. But because we can't cure the chronic illnesses that are disabling them, we are prolonging life, which is also part of our responsibility, but when prolonging life also increases suffering, we have to turn to patients for guidance. And that's sort of where I come up. I make the point in the book that if you want to die at home, you have to know when it's appropriate to say no to medical care. And the vast majority of elderly patients, when surveyed by medical professionals, note that they would like to die at home as peacefully and quietly as possible. But the majority of elderly patients still do die in institutions, either hospitals or acute care nursing homes. So there's a disconnect there that I think is important to recognize.
Certainly. A good chunk of the book, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, has to do with the death of your father. If you could, for the next couple of minutes, concisely tell us that story of how he came to die.
Well, my father and I were, he was 88. My mother passed away about 3 years before. And at 88, he was really in perfect health and living independently, and I should say he appeared to be in perfect health. But we were discussing potential treatments for a large blood vessel in his abdomen that was ballooned up, called an aortic aneurysm, and was threatening to rupture. And if it were to rupture, it would be unlikely that he would survive emergency surgery. So we were discussing preemptive treatments. And I outlined the fact that I thought the major surgery to repair it in a permanent sense was probably risky because it would cause wear and tear that would probably, he might lose his ability to live alone or live independently. And the temporary procedure, like a large cardiac catheterization done through the groin to strengthen the aneurysm, would probably offer him 3 to 5 years of life without a rupture. So, and I was encouraging him to consider the temporary procedure because I wanted him alive to meet my first grandchild. Well, he looked at me and he pointed his finger and he clenched his jaw and he asked me, why would I want to fix something that is going to carry me away the way that I want to go? And I, suddenly an academic discussion turned emotional, and I realized that he had a vision of how he wanted to die, which is quickly and decisively. Now, that didn't come to pass because he did, in fact, have the temporary procedure, and he did, in fact, live 5 more years. But when, at the 4-year mark or thereabouts, the aneurysm started to increase in size again, and he was advised he needed another procedure. And at that point, he said, no, thank you, and he canceled all his doctor's appointments. I mean, politely, he called up his doctors and said, thank you for taking care of me, but I will not pursue any further treatment. And that sort of is the crystallization of my book and knowing when you want to make that decision.
And how was his death? He was able to die at home.
He had a very quiet death at home. I was not there. I was there until about 10 days before he died, and then my older sister came to be with him as he dwindled. He was probably bedridden for about 3 weeks, and when he couldn't swallow well anymore, he stopped eating and drinking, and he passed away quietly of dehydration. Of course, nothing is ever as quiet as we like. There were moments of agitation and anxiety, but he wasn't in pain, and he was. Things were largely calm and relaxed.
Tell us a bit, in your practice, particularly with hospice and with dealing with population who will be facing death or at least were in a situation where death was very possible. How have you seen religion play into that, both positively and negatively?
Well, I'm not well educated in religion, so I can only comment peripherally. Some people find great comfort in their religion at the end of life, and others, I feel, felt that they had to soldier on because that's what their religion told them to do. And that happened both, I would say, I had Jewish patients who found comfort in their religion and others who felt they had to soldier on, and I had Catholic patients in the same circumstance. Some Catholic patients felt that it was their responsibility to continue fighting at all cost. And others took great comfort in it, and it was very difficult to predict who would fall into which camp.
How about the administration of administering of pain medication? Did you ever run into any person who was conflicted about that due to their spiritual beliefs?
Yes, people were. I have had patients. I don't write about this in the book, but I have had patients who sort of deny themselves pain medicine because they think that the pain medicine will hasten their death, and that is their right and responsibility to their right, and they are responsible to tell the doctors their wishes. But and they are correct in sort of noting that pain medicines have a dual role. They can, or a dual effect, I should say. They can hasten death if overdosed or used excessively. But I think that particular concept is a little bit overblown. I think that they're much more likely to make people comfortable without really hastening death than the alternative. And I tried my hardest to use as much pain medicine as patients would tolerate and appreciate.
Yeah, I remember kind of a sad story. My mother was helping to take care of one of my aunts in her final days, and she was doing it in concert with another aunt. So these two women were taking care of this one woman. And the my aunt, who was dying of cancer, was in excruciating pain, my mother said, and just begging for medication. And the other aunt, who was sort of the person in charge, because this was her home that the dying patient was in, she was miserly, if you will, in the administrating of the pain medication, so afraid to give too much when this poor woman had, you know, weeks to go, and she'd give half of a pill, and my mother was just so distraught because she would see my other aunt just lying there in misery. What do you do?
You remind me of a scene from my childhood where I was perhaps in third or fourth grade. This is not in the book, but my mother was a nurse professionally, and basically she was actually a pediatric nurse, but she did in fact nurse people in the neighborhood. And one of our neighbors was dying of breast cancer. I'm advised in retrospect, I didn't know that at the time, but she was in agony, and she, as a Christian Scientist, she refused pain medicine, which, now I don't know that that's standard practice, but that was the fact at the time. And my mother would come home distraught, basically crying, because she was trying to help this woman be comfortable with limited means, such as cold compresses or warm compresses or massage therapy or things of that nature, when my mother really wanted to give her pain pills and help her be more comfortable. But that was kind of an important moment that you've just reminded me of in my pre-medical training.
Doctor, we're out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but we'd love to have you back next week and continue our conversation.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Dr. Samuel Harrington, and we're talking about his book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life, and we will continue this conversation next week right here on Common Threads.